Bone-chilling greetings, everyone. The tunes are courtesy of Bobby Mackey and Stick the Landing, and I, of course, am your host, Tessa Morrow.
Now today it's a different place, all the same with a new face, with strange mysteries hanging in the air. People in their sane minds swear they see you today. Are you looking for the love they took away?
Thank you for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers podcast part of your morning, day, night, graveyard shift. Whenever you listen and wherever you are listening from the mountaintops to desolate desert, from ghost town to big city, from the East Coast to the West Coast, and everything in between, it is greatly appreciated.
Round of applause. This week's city shout-out goes to
Isla Tacalico. I know I said that wrong. Sorry. Mexico. Renton, Washington. Sherbrooke, Canada. Kastrup, Denmark. Milan, Italy. And Warsaw, Poland. Wow, I think this is like the first time ever that this has happened. 6 different countries. Neat stuff for sure. Definitely need the old passport for this one, guys. Now today, we finish the 2-part series of the Horsemonger Lane Jail. In part one, we ended with the double execution in 1812 of William Condell and John Smith for high treason. And today, in part two, we continue with executions. So on August 12th, 1833, Captain Henry Nicholl was executed for sodomy. The London Courier talks about this particular execution. Captain Henry Nicholas Nicholls, who was one of the unnatural gang to which the late Captain Bierklick belonged, and which latter gentleman put an end to his existence, was convicted on the clearest evidence at Croydon, on Saturday last, of the capital offense of sodomy. The prisoner was perfectly calm and unmoved throughout the trial, and even when sentence of death was passed upon him. In performing the duty of passing sentence of death upon the prisoner, Mr. Justice Park told him that it would be inconsistent with that duty if he held out the slightest hope that the law would not be allowed to take its severest course. At 9 o'clock in the morning, the sentence was carried into effect. The culprit, who was 50 years of age, was a fine-looking man and had served in the Peninsular War. He was connected with a highly respectable family. But since his apprehension, not a single member of it visited him. Unquote. Institutionalhistory.com gives a little bit more detail as well. The night previous to his execution, Lye slept soundly for some hours, and on awakening and inquiring the hour, appeared anxious for the arrival of the sheriff and the executioner. At 9 o'clock precisely, he was led from his cell to the place of execution, which is immediately over the entrance into the jail, and after a short time spent in prayer, the drop fell, and he soon ceased to exist. A large concourse of people assembled to witness this execution. November, Tuesday the 13th of 1849, a double execution takes place of Marie and Frederick Manning, a husband and wife executed by William Calcrate for the murder of Marie's lover, Patrick O'Connor. Patrick is murdered in his lover's home, the Manning residence, and is buried underneath the kitchen floor. Very sanitary, if I do say so myself. Ah, sweetheart, what are you cooking? What's that beautiful ripe smell? Oh, certainly not pot roast, that's for sure. So he was discovered 1 week later when a police officer noticed a soft, damp spot on the floor. Now, once the body is found, the hunt is on for the deadly couple. Once the man is deceased, Marie goes to her dead lover turned murder victim's home, where she makes herself at home, stealing all things she considered valuable. The couple who killed together now try to throw the other under the bus. No honor among thieves, or in this case, murderers. They go their separate ways. Thankfully, both are caught. Frederick is apprehended in northwest France, while Marie is captured in Edinburgh. Man and wife are reunited once more before death, and there was no longer any love or joy there. I guess when you have an affair, murder your lover with your husband, and then die for that crime, it kind of takes all the romance right out the window, doesn't it? Bummer. Now, in the crowd watching this take place were at least two notable men, Charles Dickens and the novelist who wrote Moby Dick, Herman Melville. Herman, he shared this about the executions. The man and wife were hung side by side, still unreconciled with each other. What a change from the time they stood up to be buried together. Charles Dickens had a bit more to say when it came to this execution of estranged man and wife. He shared this with the Times on the date of the execution, November the 13th in 1849. I was a witness of the execution at Horsemonger Lane this morning. I went there with the intention of observing the crowd gathered to behold it, and I had excellent opportunities of doing so, at intervals all through the night, and continuously from daybreak, until after the spectacle was over. I believe that a sight so inconceivably awful as the wickedness and levity of the immense crowd collected at that execution this morning could be imagined by no man, and could be presented in no heathen land under the sun. The horrors of the gibbet and of the crime which brought the wretched murderers to it faded in my mind before the atrocious bearing, looks, and language of the assembled spectators. When I came upon the scene at midnight, the shrillness of the cries and howls that were raised from time to time, denoting that they came from a concourse of boys and girls already assembled in the best places, made my blood run cold. As the night went on, screeching and laughing and yelling in strong chorus of parodies on negro melodies, with substitutions of Mrs. Manning for Susanna and the like were added to these. When the day dawned, thieves, low prostitutes, ruffians and vagabonds of every kind flocked onto the ground with every variety of offensive and foul behavior, fightings, faintings, whistlings, imitations of punch, brutal jokes, tumultuous demonstrations of indecent delight when swooning women were dragged out of the crowd by the police with their dresses disordered, gave a new zest to the general entertainment. When the sun rose brightly as it did, it gilded thousands upon thousands of upturned faces, so inexpressibly odious in their brutal mirth or callousness that a man had cause to feel ashamed of the shape he wore and to shrink from himself as fashioned in the image of the devil. When the two miserable creatures who attracted all this ghastly sight about them were turned quivering into the air, there was no more emotion, no more pity, no more thought that two immortal souls had gone to judgment, no more restraint in any of the previous obscenities than if the name of Christ had never been heard in this world. And there were no belief among men, but they perished like the beasts. William Godfrey Youngman was executed on September 4th, 1860, for the murder of his girlfriend turned fiance turned murder victim, Mary Streeter. It's important to note that while he was executed for this particular murder, this monster also brutally killed his own flesh and blood, his mother, and two brothers. Inconceivable. At the murder trial, it did not take long, just a mere 25 minutes, for the jury to find Youngman guilty. LondonAncestor.com talks more about the horrific murders. Mr. James Bevan said, "I reside at 16 Manor Place, Walworth. The prisoner's father occupied the top floor of that house. On the 31st of July, his family consisted of his wife, two little boys, the prisoner, and the deceased. I understand the prisoner had come to see his father on a holiday and he would sleep there. About 10 minutes to six in the morning, I was in bed and heard a noise and a heavy fall on the top floor of the house. I got up to see what was the matter, and before I could get to the door, Mr. Beard knocked on it and said, "For God's sake, come here! Here is a murder!" I went upstairs directly, and when I got to the top of the stairs, I saw the elder boy lying dead upon the landing. I did not see anything more then, but went down and dressed myself, and then saw the prisoner standing in his nightshirt on the staircase. He said to me, "My mother has done all this. She murdered my two brothers, and my sweetheart and I, in defense, believe I have murdered her." I went out and fetched the police. Susanna Beard said, "Me and my husband occupied the back room as a sleeping room. About 1 o'clock in the morning of the 31st of July, I heard a noise overheard like something very heavy falling on the boards of the bedroom above ours. My husband and I went to see what was the matter, and he called out, 'Murder!' and came downstairs. He afterwards went up again with the landlord. I went to the door of our room and saw the prisoner standing on the staircase. He said, 'Mrs. Beard, my mother, has done all of this. She has murdered my sweetheart and my two little brothers, and I believe in self-defense that I have murdered her.'" Philip Beard, the husband of the last witness, said, "I had seen the prisoner in our house a few days. I remember being awoke by my wife, and I heard a rambling on the landing. The noise was like that of children running about. I went out of my room and I heard a slight scream. When I got to the outside of my room, I saw some blood on the stairs, and on the top of the staircase, I saw the little boy lying on the landing. His throat was cut, and he was dead. I then saw the body of the deceased lying a little beyond that of the boy. I did not observe any other bodies at the time, as I was very much alarmed, and I went down and called the landlord. And he went upstairs together, and I went to dress. I then fetched a policeman and a surgeon. I saw the prisoner upon the stairs, and he told me that his mother had done it all and that he murdered her in self-defense." First of all, you murder your family, your mother, who you shared a heartbeat with for 9 months, and your two brothers that you grew up with, and the love of your life, or the supposed love of your life, and then, to make matters worse, insult to injury to the family, you then throw your mother under the bus, saying that she did all of this. It was her. I'm the hero. I killed her before she could kill anybody else. Dude, what a coward. Samuel Wright was executed on January 12, 1864, for the murder of his lover, Maria Green. Samuel suffers heartbreak when his beloved wife suddenly dies, leaving him alone with their two young children. Now, it's heartbreaking that he had to deal with this, right? And he probably wasn't used to being a single parent, obviously. But what he does, he leaves his two children with his parents, who consisted of a 65-year-old half-blind father and a mother who was deaf. And then he goes off and meets this woman who's 10 years older than him, Maria Green, and they end up living together. And I found some information on barristerblogger.com, and it goes kind of into detail about what took place that night. Shortly after 4 a.m., Hannah Ireland, the tenant in the room immediately below Sam and Maria's room, was woken by loud cries. She went upstairs to be confronted by a scene of horror. Maria Green was lying on the point of death near the fireplace. She was just able to articulate the words, "He has done it! He has cut my throat!" before expiring from the effects of two deep wounds on either side of her neck. Wright was not in the room at first, but returned almost immediately. He, too, was covered in blood, not only that of Maria, but also some from cuts of his own hands and face. The weapon that had inflicted the injuries was obvious, a fearsome cut, throat razor, dripping with blood. Miss Ireland ran into the street to fetch a constable, and shortly afterwards, P.C. Newton arrived to find Sam sitting in the room next to his lover's corpse. Sam handed the police officer the razor, remarking as he did so, "I did it with this, and I suppose I shall be hung." Now, is it just me, or is it like, wow, Miss Ireland, who went in there and saw this bloody scene and then literally sees him come over covered in blood? Obviously, he's the culprit, the murderer. I'm shocked that he did not kill her. And I'm glad that he didn't. I'm glad there wasn't a double homicide. But wow, she is so lucky to have gotten away with her life. And not only that, but she ran and got help. So Shepherd Taylor, who bore witness to the execution, he describes the scene. "I saw Samuel Wright hanged on the roof of Horsemonger Lane Jail for the murder of a paramour. This man, a bricklayer, 3 years ago found and returned to me a silver watch which I had lost. It was a remarkable case in the fact that the murder and the coroner's inquest, the magisterial investigation, the trial, and the sentence all took place in a week. The general public and all the newspapers, without exception, advocated clemency on the part of the Crown, but the Home Secretary was inexorable. The blinds were down in all the neighboring streets, and the military were called out in case of an attempted rescue. When the unfortunate man appeared on the scaffold, loud cries of 'Take him down!' were heard in every direction, to which the unhappy man responded by repeated bows to the multitude. He still continued bowing, and was actually bowing when the drop fell." The last public execution would be that of Louis Bourdois. On October 15, 1867, executed by William Callcrat. 2 hours prior to Lewis's execution, William Callcrat had been across the Thames, hanging John Wiggins, who, like Lewis, had slit his girlfriend Anne Oakes' throat. Lewis is furious when his live-in lover, Marianne Snow, leaves him for another man. The French leather worker and Mary Ann had lived together as common law partners for over 13 years in England. Now, the day after she left him, he finds her and slits her throat. Now, death is not instantaneous. She manages to crawl to her aunt's bedroom, as her aunt had been living with them, and she's completely just caked in her own blood. And then she collapses in front of her aunt. She would die a few hours later in the hospital. Now, a few hours, it's like, oh, okay, that's not too long, but I think everybody can agree that if you're in that situation where you are fighting for your life and you were just brutally attacked, your throat cut, I'm sure every second felt like an eternity. That poor, poor woman. Now, there was no doubt that Lewis was the culprit. Lewis had recently written a letter to his brother admitting that he wanted Marianne dead. Not only that, but it would have been, if his plans went like he wanted them to, a murder-suicide, as he had planned to murder not only Marianne, but their children, then end it all by killing himself. Now, probably one of the most infamous of wretched souls to be executed here at Horsemonger Lane Jail was a child serial killer and baby farmer named Margaret Waters. Mothers trusted the notorious baby farmer with their precious newborn babies, putting them into her care. Margaret would starve them, drug them, murder them, get rid of their bodies so they would not inconvenience her. I mean, she was a true monster. Her murder count is 19, but the number is believed to actually be much higher. People like Margaret Waters does not stop killing. The only way to stop the senseless killings is to apprehend the monster. So after her husband passes away, Waters becomes a baby farmer. She goes down in criminal history as being the first to be convicted as a baby farmer and hanged in England. She is hanged by executioner William Callcrat. When the authorities went to her home, a grisly sight welcomed them. This is what the reporting officer wrote in his report. "Some half dozen little infants lay together on a sofa, filthy, starving, and stupefied by laudanum. I mean, can you imagine if she hadn't been caught right then and there and those children continued to stay in her care? That surely would have been an additional 6 victims to add to her body count. Again, just a true monster. So on October 12th of 1870, the day after the child serial killer's execution, The Guardian released an article that went into detail about the execution day, and I want to read some of that right now. After the rope had been adjusted, she, in a calm and composed tone, uttered what was described by those who heard it as a beautiful extempore prayer. Though most of the spectators were more or less inured to scenes of horror, several were visibly affected. One kneeling on the bare ground, and another one leaning, overcome with emotion, against the prison wall. "Alas," she said to the chaplain, "Mr. Joseph, do you think I am saved?" A whispered reply from the clergyman conveyed his answer to that momentous question. All left the scaffold except the convict. The bolt was withdrawn, and almost without a struggle, Margaret Waters ceased to exist. The London Museum has an image of an old flyer that goes into detail about this monster's final moments. Many would create something like this to sell and hand out to the people, a little souvenir from the big day, if you will. It reads this: "This morning, Tuesday, the wretched woman Margaret Waters, the notorious baby farmer, underwent the extreme penalty of the law at Horsemonger Lane Jail for the murder of a child named Cohen at Brixton. The prisoner, since conviction, made a statement in which she denied all intention of committing murder, but said she gave the children all nourishment she could, as far as her means would allow. She acknowledged to having left some of the babies in the care of children in the street and then went away, so that they might be taken to the workhouse and then she would be rid of them. She also said that, being so poor, that when any of them died, she packed them up in brown paper and left them in different parts of town, where any rubbish was accumulated. She acknowledges to nearly 20 bodies. Since her condemnation, the prisoner has been very ill, and for the last 4 or 5 days has been confined to her couch. Her brothers visited yesterday, and the parting scene was an extremely painful affair. The worthy chaplain has been unremitting in his attentions to her, and has showed the evil course of her life, and tried his utmost endeavors to bring her to a state of mind so that she might fully understand the awful position in which she stood, and in which he fully succeeded. The sheriff arrived at once, with the other officials, proceeded to the condemned cell. The executioner, having been introduced, proceeded at once to fasten the prisoner's hands, arms, and legs so as to prevent her struggling at the gallows. Everything being in readiness, the procession was formed, and then it was found necessary to obtain a chair as the prisoner was too feeble to walk. They then began to move forward through the various passages of the prison towards the yard where the gallows was erected, where, having arrived, the prisoner fainted away, and appeared to be entirely overcome. After a few minutes, she revived, and thanked the whole of the officials for their kind attention to her. The cap was then drawn over her face, the rope adjusted, the bolt drawn, and the wretched creature was launched into eternity. John Copin was a drunk who one night got so mad at his wife, 32-year-old Emma, when she did not want to get into bed with him, because he was acting so belligerent, mind you. Thinking about this all night, he grows more angry, and his blood is boiling, and the very next day he grabs a butcher knife and he murders her. October the 14th of 1874, the following day after his execution, the Times releases this statement: "The Camberwell murder. Yesterday, John Walter Copin, the coffee house keeper of Church Street, Camberwell, who was convicted at the last Old Bailey sessions of the willful murder of his wife, expiated his crime with his life at Horsemonger Lane Jail. In this instance, the recommendation to mercy of the jury was disregarded, as was the memorial of a body of tradesmen and others in the Camberwell district, who had petitioned that the life of the convict should be spared on the ground that the act was done in a passion to which all men and women were liable. I will share two final executions. Both took place in 1877. Caleb Smith, he's executed for the murder of his common-law wife, Emma Elizabeth Osborne. They spent the evening drinking, and things get rather heated when they get into a verbal disagreement about something. It turns physical when Emma slaps Caleb, and that slap, well, it sealed her fate. Once he was hit, he saw red, grabs a nearby razor, and he slashes her throat. He then attempts suicide, but he fails. A private execution takes place August 14, 1877, and it's conducted by executioner William Marwood. And the final execution I want to talk about today is that of Isaac Marks. He is one of the final executions that takes place here at Horsemonger Lane Jail. The 23-year-old Jewish antiques dealer was engaged to be married to a woman named Carolyn Bernard. Marrying his true love, he should have been on top of the world. But sadly, something happens that changes his life forever. His house suffers a horrific fire, and the end result, it burns to the ground. Frederick Bernard, Carolyn's father and Isaac's soon-to-be father-in-law, steps in to help the young man. He doesn't even think twice. He spends a lot of time helping Isaac Marks, getting the insurance claim situated, among other things. And at the end of it all, Frederick hands Isaac a bill. Now, this shocked Isaac. He was expecting Frederick to do all of this stuff for free, but here a bill sits in his hands. He is infuriated. That bill may have sealed Frederick Bernard's fate, but when Isaac Marks shot Frederick, which was fatal, that sealed his fate as well. A final date with the executioner, William Marwood. Now, it's interesting to me that he went right to murder. He could have tried to say, hey, like, what's going on, first of all? Like, you should have said that you wanted to charge me for this so I knew ahead of time. He could have, you know, talked to him about it like a human being. He could have went the whole, I'm gonna shoo you kind of route. To me, there's other things to do than murder. Just like the man or the woman who doesn't want to be married anymore, so they have their spouse killed or they kill their spouse themselves. Have you ever heard of divorce? Yeah, it's a pain in the ass and it takes time and money and energy, but guess what? Afterwards, you have your lives. You could do whatever you want.
And that concludes another fantastic podcast. Legend has it, if you don't tune in, I'll be returning to haunt you. So make sure to tune in for the next episode.
Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They are all spooktacular. Haven't heard every single one yet? Well, that's an easy fix. You can binge listen to your heart's fright and delight by hitting up any of those awesome podcast platforms, such as Deezer, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean, Pocket Cast, Podcast Republic, CastBox. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Brothers Podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, everyone, and
I will see you next week.